Yes, now on Books and Arts Daily, we turn our attention to the patronage of the arts. Neil Balnaves was Managing Director of the Hanna-Barbera Studios and then of Southern Star TV Production Company, which was responsible for some of Australia's most popular television programs, and he made a fortune. But then in 2002, a boating accident saw Neil on life support for several weeks and confined to bed for 6 months. And this proved to be the end of his high-level corporate career and the start of a new chapter in his life as a philanthropist. In 2006, he established the Balnaves Foundation, and every year the foundation invests more than $2 million to support organisations in education, medicine and the arts, with a focus on young people, the disadvantaged and Indigenous communities. Neil Balnaves, welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you, Michael.
Can you just remind the listeners of the power and scope of Southern Star? It developed all sorts of dramas. I mean, I think of Blue Heelers and The Secret Life of Us, Water Rats, Big Brother.
It was one of those companies that, I don't know, found its day. The early part of when we commenced in television was really all about miniseries and to what I called one-level dimension Australian dramas. And I think we were lucky at being able to get into the forefront of drama with a number of sub-levels, which created a form of entertainment that really turned Australian television drama around, and Australian content went through the roof. And we rode that lucky wave for some 10, 15 years, doing dramatically long series of Blue Heelers, Water Rats. In those days, it was unusual for a series to run 3 or 4 years, except the old Crawford specials like Homicide and shows like that. So we were the production company that ran the 70s and 80s.
Have you ever gone back and watched an old Crawford production of Homicide?
Yes, actually, not so long ago. It was on a piece of cable TV I was watching. They were just great shows.
They were filmed on the smell of an oily rag, weren't they? You're aware
Absolutely.
Of the you know, the sort of cardboard sets and the incredible economy of the whole exercise.
Yep. No, they were they were done on a shoestring. There was not a lot of money around in television in those days, and I think the proprietors in television didn't want to spend too much either. They were required to do the Australian content by law, and as a result of that requirement, never really put the money into the budgets. However, what they did do was they proved Australian content could stand on its own 2 feet and really appeal to a mass audience in this country, which is great.
What are the biggest achievements of that period of your life?
Oh, golly, I think you'd have to say there's a couple of standouts, I think, and this may be a little bit biased, but the fact that we produced a television miniseries called Return to Eden that went to air in America and was rated on a network over there as one of the highest rated TV series of all time, and the same in the UK on the BBC. That was a feather in our cap. There was the time we did another miniseries with Linda Evans and Jason Robards called The Last Frontier, which also rated extremely well both in America and in the UK and Europe. Those sort of really helped put Australian content right up there in anything being done by either of those two countries. And they're great standards. But then on the other hand, regular, you know, 13 years of Blue Heelers, 8 years of Water Rats, you know, they are great shows that still run today a lot around worldwide. I mean, you can be sitting in Italy watching a television station in Florence and watching the dubbed version of Water Rats any day of the week.
So there you are. You're a player in this very exciting industry, and then everything changes. You have this, well, tell us, you have an accident.
Yep. I ended up having a pretty shocking accident in my late 50s, and it was a boating accident that really flattened me. I was pretty badly damaged and spent a long time recovering. It took me almost a year to really regain something of my old strength and something, I mean, being able to walk and do things. I still have certain things in life I can't do. It's no good getting me to run anywhere. That's not going to happen. But I've been able to do most things.
So it's not too much to say that this period of a year on the flat of your back, I guess, made you reassess what you were doing with your life.
Well, it was a reassessment brought about by the accident causing me to not be able to travel to the large extent I did. I mean, I was pretty much a constant traveler worldwide. I'd been on about a 3-year program of trying to build a bigger company overseas than we had here in Australia, because we'd got to the point in Australia where we were really by far and away the dominant company, and you weren't going to be allowed to grow by the Australian television networks to be any bigger than that. So to get growth for the business, we were really trying to expand very heavily in the United Kingdom to get into the European content issue, and also in the North American market. So that required me to be traveling almost every month, and I was spending a lot of my time overseas, and had nearly finished the acquisition program that I wanted to do, and then I got flattened and I was out of circulation for a year, and then I realized I just couldn't keep up to that amount of travel.
So you make some big changes. Tell us what they are.
Well, changes were that obviously I couldn't fly around as much as I did. I had some real pain issues and body strengthening issues that I had to spend some years getting right. That led me to spend a lot of time reflecting on what I would do. That led to me coming to the conclusion I shouldn't stand in the way of my business growing, and that I needed to sell it. And then the business was sold, and it was bought by a company called Southern Cross Communications, which owned a lot of radio and television stations. Southern Cross then subsumed Southern Star. Then I went on the board of Southern Cross, and I geared my life down. And then having done that, though, having sold it, I realised that there was considerable profits to be that were made out of selling the business. And what was I going to do with them? And there was that sort of quite weird stage where you think, oh, well, a bigger boat would be nice, and maybe a plane would be lovely, and maybe a bigger house. Then you realised after a couple of years that that was pretty false. And then that brought into the existence the foundation. I really came to the conclusion, quite unaffectedly, that it was good to give something back to the country that had been good to me.
So you've set up the Balnaves Foundation. It gives away a couple of $1 million every year. How do you decide who it goes to?
Tough part. I mean, there's some pretty compelling stats here in Australia. There is two issues emerging. One is government's giving less. That's pretty apparent. Commercial enterprises are giving less, and private philanthropy is giving more. Now, that puts a lot of pressure on people like myself, and there are thousands like me, who are giving considerable amounts of money away in this country. And on the other hand of the argument, you've got 20,000 registered charities. So you've got 20,000 very good causes chasing a defined amount of money, and it's weighing that up and living with that issue and that choice of choice-making that creates a lot of difficulty, really, because most things appeal to you most of the time.
Hmm. Well, you give money across a range of causes, particularly to medical research, but since this is an art show, perhaps we could talk about your commitment to the arts. You've made a big commitment to sculpture. Why that of all the art forms?
Well, sculpture came about because I didn't really get into art that much until my later life, and I think it was easy enough to see that there were plenty of art prizes. There was an art prize a month somewhere, from the Archibald down to regional galleries to every state. But there was a funny thing about sculpture. There was not much support for it. And the real tragic part of sculpture is it's just as vibrant, but it wasn't getting the public support. So there weren't the prizes. And then along came David Handley in Sculpture by the Sea and completely changed that argument, where he mounted a public event, lasted 10 days and brought 500,000 people to come and see it. I mean, so there was that proof that there was real big demand for sculpture in the right environment.
And Neil, I'll just interrupt you there because there are people listening all over Australia and across the world online, so they won't know about Sculpture by the Sea. So this is a big event that's held every year in Sydney, around the sort of Bondi region, and there's a pathway that sort of curls along the top of the cliff there. It's the most beautiful location, and at intervals along that pathway, once a year, all this sculpture materialises, and it attracts thousands of people who probably at other times of the year don't go looking for art, but suddenly there it all is, and it's the most wonderful occasion. So you've been putting up the prize money for this, is that right?
That's right. We've been putting up the prize, and that is really to recognise the obviously the winning artist, but it's also to really give a reason to focus attention on the whole event itself. It's pretty special. I mean, compared to anything else in Australia, it's the most highly attended art event in a short period of time. I mean, nearly 500,000 people go through in 10 days, and that doesn't represent sometimes the whole attendance at an art gallery all year.
They've started doing this in the West as well, in Western Australia.
That's right, Cottesloe Beach. They have a Western Australia version, and with the assistance of Her Royal Highness Prince Mary Denmark with the Crown Prince, they do one in Denmark. So there are three now, one in Denmark, one in Western Australia, one in New South Wales, and they are pretty unique events.
On Books and Arts Daily, this is Michael Cathcart, and I'm talking to Neil Balnaves about the Balnaves Foundation, the foundation he set up after he had a very serious boating accident, and sold his company and discovered that he had a lot of cash, and that he decided to give it away. Now, you're also giving funding to the Art Gallery of New South Wales to do a survey of sculpture in Australia. What's that about? Why do we need a survey of sculpture?
Well, funnily enough, it's an important part of the collecting of material. There's never been an updated survey done of Australian sculptors and their works. It just doesn't exist. So it's not a large grant, but it is aimed right squarely at making sure that we have a proper record of all of our sculptors and their works in one central point. It's really, really quite amazing, but that doesn't exist until now.
Now, another project that's caught my eye is at the Gallery of South Australia, and this one's about children and art. Tell us about that.
Well, we took a view that, you know, it's easier to probably run the flag up and say, okay, we're doing a sculpture event every year in each state or be rather general in an approach, or do we want to be entrepreneurial and something a little bit different? And we took the view that the best way to create a groundswell of change about arts right across the board in this country was to try and get young people involved earlier. The aim was really to expose a new generation of young Australians to the arts world so that it's not regarded as an area of an elite few, that it has a very broad franchise right across the country, that people can be exposed to art. So the whole idea was we do it in Adelaide through a program that's called START, which is really for very young children with their parents to come in once a month into the art gallery, and they have their own tours, they have their own room to go and do and create their own art as a result of the tours. They get talked to, and it's really, really appeals to 3-4-year-olds up to 9, 10, 11-year-olds, and that is working brilliantly now. They get 400 to 500 parents and children every month down there in Adelaide. Now, if over 3, 5, 7 years, that reaches another 8,000-10,000 young people, that will be a lot better than my day when I would grow up in Adelaide, where there was no such thing. I mean, art was a very distant concept. You were not allowed to take a hand out of place. You actually had to keep your hands in your pocket, and you could look, but you couldn't touch. So we're trying to just bring about a sea change in Australia's attitudes to arts, that it should not be on a pedestal. It should be something for everybody. And it's something that everyone can have a view about. And that way will probably change this precocious attitude that politicians have with the arts pretty much across the board, where they see it as an elitist concept, that there's very little public appeal to it, and there's certainly no votes in it. Now, if we can change that attitude and it's properly supported by governments, it'll be a major step forward. I mean, we have a continuing problem in this country. The government is giving less and less, particularly at the federal level. The amount of money supporting the arts has gone backwards year on year on year. Now, that's a sad state of affairs, because if you really look at it, what is your arts? Your arts is more about the soul of your country. Your medical research, your hospitals may be more about the brain food, or your education may be your brain food, but we're talking about the soul of a country, the essence of a country. You know, we had such a great history of wonderful writers brilliant actors. We had a great history of great artists. And we've got to keep that growing. We've got to keep the soul of this country moving forward, because otherwise, left to the politicians, they've got no idea.
Neil, it's hard to think of a politician on either side of politics who talks like this. I just don't know where we find a voice or an advocate for the arts within the political scene. Do you see this as part of the currency that anybody's spending in their political budget?
Oh, I think this is a looming problem for this country, that we are being starved of funds. I mean, look, in basic...
Well, I was really using that as a metaphor. I really meant, you know, are there people in the parliament who you're hearing who are saying that the arts matter and that I will campaign for the arts?
No, not at all. Not at all since the days of Keating, Whitlam, where there was a resurgence in the arts sector. No. There's a whole bunch of Philistines out there that don't really have an attitude, nor do they actively do anything, and they just hide behind constant reports, constant regurgitation of reports, constant examination. And, you know, you get very used to this idea at Canberra. You know, if you just don't want to face up to anything, you cause another report to be written, and you constantly never deal with it.
What about the Venice Biennale? I know you've got a finger in that pie.
Yep, we are the major funder of the Venice Biennale with the Australia Council. And we took the view that sort of is the apex of Australian art going overseas. And that was something that the government was not prepared to continue to increase funding for. So we stepped up to the plate to bring private philanthropy into that area to help launch Australian artists on the world stage. I mean, there's no bigger art event in the world than the Venice Biennale, and it would be a tragedy if Australia's involvement in that was scaled down or watered down or was reduced in any form. So there's not just me, but there's a lot of Australians that are putting their hands in their pocket now to support Venice because they see it as a platform. But I still wonder, at the end of the day, why we pay our taxes on an ever-increasing scale whilst politicians' salaries go up. The funding to events like this and the arts go backwards. It's sad.
Neil, have you thought through the question of how you put your name to this kind of effort? Because some people think of philanthropy as something that should be done discreetly, that if you put your name to it, you're sort of big-noting yourself. Have you thought through that as a question?
Look, it'd be fair to say that I get some criticism on the fact that I go out and I spruik what philanthropy is about or what we do as a foundation. And I'm a great believer in that. Going back on it historically, philanthropy was really the province of old families, estates, trustees, doling money out after the founder had died. And they were basically grants out of the dark or under the table or out of the cupboard. There was no real view about making it public. Then in my generation, there's been a lot of first-time wealth, a lot of people putting their hands up and saying, look, I've made money for the first time, and I'm prepared to give it away. I mean, it's something that you either can handle discreetly, and I don't mind. I don't have a problem with that. I've just taken the view that, you know, I hope by example I'll interest someone else. If I just interest one more person in doing something, it's better than doing nothing at all to help this country. I mean, you know, we owe it a lot, and we've got to put something back into it. Otherwise, it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, Neil, it's been terrific to talk to you. Thank you for making the time to have a chat.
That's great, Michael. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Good idea. Neil Balnaves is the founder of the philanthropic Balnaves Foundation, and part of its mission is to provide funding for the arts. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily.